from George Blood Audio. And first, I wanted to thank all of the panelists here for their time and attention on addressing this topic. In this session, David Peter Coppin, Michael Casey, Patrick Midling, and Jenny Doctor will discuss approaches to handling preservation of audio within their respective institutions. David Peter Coppin has a bachelor's in music from the University of Michigan and a master's from the University of Illinois. He serves as project archivist for an NEH-funded preservation project at the SOSA Archives for band research at the University of Illinois. Since 1999, he has served as special collections librarian and archivist of the Sibley Music Library, Eastman School of Music. He oversees use of the Eastman Audio Archive, the collection highlighted in today's presentation. Alongside his professional library service, he's actively engaged as an applied musician, working in solo, vocal, and chamber repertory.
Thank you, Martha. Houston, we have liftoff. Hello, everyone. Earlier today, Jerry Szymanski, Tim Fabrizio, and Dave Lewis informed us on culture, industry, and recorded sound in Rochester. My talk comes as a continuation of that theme centered on the local context of the Eastman School of Music. In speaking of the Eastman School's audio archive, I am addressing content rather than technique or procedure. And if anyone present should wish to learn about the technical aspects of what Eastman has done over the years, I do invite you to contact me outside of this venue. And before I begin my text proper, I would like to recognize two of my Eastman colleagues here present today. First, Michael Farrington, would you stand, please? Member of the Eastman School's recording engineering team for 10 years. And Michael works with me, alongside me, in bringing access to researchers access to the archival recorded content. I would also like to recognize Suzanne Stover, longtime ARSC member and Eastman School of Music officer in both the archival audio capacity and also in the school's advancement department. Suzanne, in previous years, has overseen a massive preservation effort over so much of the archival audio content. The Eastman Audio Archive today is a repository encompassing live performance material of the Eastman School of Music based on the following capture targets. And let me first introduce that the Eastman School of Music, founded in 1921, is an institution of higher learning connected to the University of Rochester, granting degrees in performance, composition, music education, theory, and history, and more recently, since academic year 1971-72, in jazz and contemporary media. Today, the capture targets for the archival content are student degree recitals, as well as selected non-degree recitals by our enrolled students. Student ensemble performances, whether chamber or large ensembles. Recital performances by our faculty members. Operatic productions, strictly audio, not video. And special music programming such as festivals. And finally, major school events, which can include convocations. Altogether, looking at the entire collection by format, holdings from 1933 to 1955 in instantaneous discs, both aluminum and glass at varying times. I beg your pardon. 1950 through 1990, broadly speaking, was the era of analog tape at the Eastman School, monaural, binaural, and stereophonic with Dolby noise reproduction. From 1990 through 1998, the era of digital stereophonic tape, specifically format Mitsubishi X86, which has in recent years presented us with a preservation opportunity. And ARSC, among, speaking as diplomatically as I can, in 2006, the association very generously granted the Eastman School of Music some preservation funds to assist in that effort. We have made use of a composite assembly of funds from various grantor agencies. From 1998 through 2009, magneto-optical disc technology. And in 2009, the magneto-optical disc was discontinued in favor of using Macintosh Pro computers and compact flash recorders for the capture. And for retention, 24-bit 96 kilohertz individual WAV files saved to a server. Three essential facts I would note about the collection is that the earliest retained master of a live performance event dates from the Eastman School's annual Festival of American Music, May 1933. Earlier today, Dave Lewis spoke about the festivals. The internal recording program of the Eastman School was expanded to a near comprehensive level with the migration to analog tape in the 1950s. It was with the introduction of tape that the number of events captured greatly expanded. And uses of the archival content include personal and professional advancement by our students and faculty, research by researchers from outside as well as internally, and also the Eastman School's own institutional promotion. I might add a fourth, which is something passed around verbally within Eastman, to the effect that the Eastman School's audio archive represents the oldest continuously maintained audio archive of any school of music in the United States. I hesitate to make the claim here today because I've not yet substantiated it through any formal survey. I would like to talk about the origins of the collection, and the origins all come back to this man, Dr. Howard Hanson, director of the Eastman School for 40 years, 1924 through 64. This is Dr. Hanson as a younger man, published in the 1934 yearbook of the Eastman School. In his annual report to the university president, Dr. Rush Rees, in May 1934, Dr. Hanson wrote, and we have the draft of his report within the Howard Hanson papers. The actual formally signed copy is in the Rush Rees papers at the university's main library. In that much more formal time, dear President Rees, I beg to submit herewith my report for the academic year 1933-34. And on the second page there on the right, it is the last paragraph I want to focus on. Using my very best guttural Hanson voice, as he would stroke his goatee, "More than a year ago, we began experimentation in sound recording for pedagogical purposes. We have now progressed to the point where our reproductions are sufficiently accurate in quality to be of practical value. And we have installed in Kilburn Hall an excellent sound apparatus for the playing of these recordings. It is now possible, for example, for a student to sing an aria with orchestra and to hear that aria reproduced a few minutes later in the same auditorium. The value of this method of objective criticism is apparent, and we are planning to extend the application of this experimentation into other fields." So wrote Dr. Hanson to Dr. Rees. In a few minutes, you'll hear Hanson's own voice, and you can let me know how close I came. And while I'm still on Hanson, What we can extrapolate from this is that within Mr. Eastman School of Music, the creative minds and the administrative minds were striving to be as innovative as possible in their development of talent and in the preparation for performance. That innovation took the form of exploiting the latest technologies. There had been a precedent for same just a few years previously when the school's opera department had been founded in 1923. That was the work of Vladimir Rosing, seen here on the Eastman School faculty from 1923 to 29. And he and his colleague and collaborator, assistant director Ruben Mamboulian, gentleman unfortunately with eyes closed, seated there next to Rosing in that photograph. I've cropped it, but surrounded by operatic students. They themselves together were the direction of the opera department, and they were using motion picture cameras to film students in operatic rehearsals, thereby affording the students a living means to carry out objective criticism of themselves. And by the way, a point of trivia for the music librarians in the room, the young man seated there on the floor is Nicholas Leninsky, whose first job in the United States of America was as a vocal coach and accompanist within the Eastman School's opera department. In 1935, the Rochester Press published an article, June 30th, 1935, this copy preserved in a scrapbook within the Sibley Music Library. Music recorded in laboratory at school. Director tells story of the development of project in attic room of institution. And Dr. Hansen is quoted at length verbatim for several paragraphs, and I can say the Rochester Press was always generous to Dr. Hansen by producing his words in toto. An extensive article quoting him, charting out his aims and objectives, and with a photograph of him there at the controls of the recording room. From this article, three objectives become clear. He was interested in capturing new works in their first performance, or performances, because some works had more than one performance at Eastman. The capture of student performances for the educational value of objective criticism, and the capture of neglected repertory and systematic programming for performance by designated performers. So that last interest was never fully realized, but the first two very much informed the early experimentation in recording. So, some specific examples of archival content from the Eastman Audio Archive. Surveying the collection today, the primary interest is quite simply the concert life of the home institution, much of which has been presented in fulfillment of academic requirements. Here is where I get to run through the names of now famous alumni. The collection includes the master of the 1983 master's degree recital by a voice major named Renee Fleming. Also, the 1959 senior recital of a double bassist named Ron Carter, now a jazz great, and the masters of performances of student works by fledgling composers Alexander Courage and Charles Strauss. The former, later the composer for the Star Trek television series, and the latter, known for his Broadway musicals, Bye Bye Birdie and Annie. Alongside the academically required programming has gone a great deal of content that may now be described as historically significant, in particular with respect to American music. To illustrate my point, I will present excerpts from several live events, each one representative of some specific research interest or curricular objective of the Eastman School. And while these excerpts will not do full justice to my topic, the limitation on number is a necessary concession to our time allotment today. So first, we are at the Festival of American Music in 1934, fourth in the series of annual festivals. And there in the listing the program selections on the right, our attention is going to be Hans Bialik, Austrian-born composer and orchestrator, born 1894, died 1983. And from that year's festival comes this photograph of Howard Hansen on the left, standing with, in front of other composers from left to right, Hans Bialik, Burl Phillips, Eastman alumnus faculty member, Walter Kramer, Bernard Rogers, third from the right, Eastman faculty, Mark Wessel, Edward Royce, and seated are Martha Alter, an ESM Eastman School alumna, and Jerry McGanahan. The Spialik work, The Tall City, a tone poem, was representative of Hansen's programming at the annual festivals in two respects. First, the music is solidly tonal and accessible. Second, its composer held a day job. In this instance, Mr. Spialik was working for the music publisher Harms Incorporated. And just a word on that point. In the main, it was not the truly professional composers whom Howard Hansen championed in his American Composers Concerts and Festivals of American Music, but rather those who were toiling in academe and in other pursuits and who were composing for the love of it. The economic reality is that Hansen neither paid honoraria nor compensated the composers for the expense of providing scores and parts for the Rochester programming. In his eyes, a Rochester performance opportunity was a sufficient honor in and of itself. Maestro, if we might please have the first excerpt. This is the opening of The Tall City by Spialik, conducted by Hansen. Programmatic, emblematic of Spialik's work on Broadway alongside such people as Robert Russell Bennett. And I don't know about you all, but I can see a refrain on the screen as this music is being played. Thank you, Ricardo Chaker. I should add that the Spialik programming was, in one respect, an irregular programming choice at an American music festival, in that it represented an instance of Hansen programming a work that had already entered the repertory. The Tall City had been composed for the occasion of the opening of Radio City, and it had become well known through repeated broadcasts across the nation. The printed program for the festival billed the performance as the first live performance of the work, something I've yet to do the research on as to whether the claim is in fact supportable. And as a footnote, I want to add that the concert repertory programmed in Hansen's American Music Initiatives between 1925 and 1971 was all cited in this booklet, a cumulative repertory list that the Eastman School published in 1972. Copies are available on request. Fully 74% of the repertory cited herein is represented in one format or another in the Eastman Audio Archive, thereby furnishing audio research material for the interested party. And admittedly, at this time, 20th century American music, specifically that school of American music founded on tonal centers and constructed around established classical structures, is not prominent in the trends of academic study, but it remains to be seen whether tonal American music will again regain a foothold within the academic establishment. Next, we move forward a dozen years to the 1946 Festival of American Music, to an event that signified the public introduction of jazz into the concert life of the Eastman School of Music. There you have on the screen the lineup of concerts for that annual festival, and April 16th, the next to last concert in the festival. Program of concert music in the jazz idiom. Please don't tell me we're not holding it at arm's length. Conductor for the evening was Jack End, here at Eastman School graduate. This was his senior portrait in the 1940 yearbook, and this was a later portrait in the 1940s, the work of Alexander Levinson, who was, by the way, concertmaster of the Rochester Philharmonic. For four decades, the Eastman School has embraced jazz within its curriculum. For just over six decades, the school has sponsored live jazz programming within its venues, but that has not always been the case. Up until 1946, Howard Hansen had used his position to rail publicly against jazz and other forms of popular music. And so this concert on April 16th, 1946, is significant not only for marking the first live performance of jazz at the Eastman School and programmed under the auspices of a festival Festival of American Music, which afforded the spotlight of publicity, but was further remarkable because the event was introduced by Hansen himself, and moreover, sympathetically so. Preserved in a scrapbook at the Sibley Music Library is this article published April 17, 1946, the very next day. Dr. Hansen defends jazz, youth swarm to festival. Hansen's remarks published in full but of relevance to us. His remarks were captured on disc together with the musical performance, and the audio representation confirms that the press did not publish his remarks entirely verbatim. In any event, we'll hear just a little of this segment of text. Maestro, please.
The time has apparently come, in fact it is perhaps way overdue, when we should recognize that popular music should not be measured entirely in terms of the thermometer, but that its possibilities for concert as well as for the dance, which are enormous, should be distinguished by variation between good and bad jazz, between creative and non-creative popular music, between imaginative popular music and stereotyped popular music, and that these differences are just as great as similar differences in the field of serious music. In this field, too, there will be norms of excellence which will vary from person to person. As in the field of serious music, there will be differences of opinion as to what is good and what is bad. It is high time, however, that popular music should be studied and discussed as on a qualitative as well as a quantitative basis, so that we as musicians are able to form in our own minds adequate criteria for the judgment of this music.
Next, this is the beginning of Jack N's composition.
The time has apparently come, in fact, it is perhaps way overdue, when we should recognize that popular music should not be measured entirely...
So really, the Hansen remarks were almost as significant as the music itself. I'm fast coming up to 20 minutes, and so Okay. One more excerpt, and that is going to be, we're going to a concert featuring the Eastman Rochester Symphony Orchestra with Eastman student soloists, March 23rd, 1950. It was, in the academic year 1949-1950, the fourth graduation concert with orchestra. Now, student concerto performances are a mainstay in any school of music, permitting the most advanced students to show off their chops against the accompaniment of a full orchestra. But at the Eastman School, for more than 20 years, the concerto concerts featured orchestral accompaniment by no less than a professional orchestra, conducted by a Pulitzer Prize laureate on the podium, and that was Hansen, who won the Pulitzer in 1944, for his fourth symphony. Beginning in academic year 1942-43, Hansen pressed the Eastman Rochester into service under his baton as the customary orchestral personnel for the Eastman School's concerto concerts. From the late 1940s, here is a photograph of a student acknowledging applause, being congratulated by Dr. Hansen, and you will see behind the podium the players there all look to be mature, and that is, they were not in fact all students, but they were members of the local civic orchestra. And this points up one of the twin facets of the Eastman Rochester's mission, primarily making commercial recordings of American music, but in the second place, the Eastman Rochester gave many a live performance in Rochester. Historically, the origin of the Eastman Rochester was summed up by Hansen himself in a letter that he addressed to Macklin Marrow of RCA in October 1944, and this carbon copy coming from the Howard Hansen papers, and specifically within this paragraph, he cites, encapsulates the origin of the Eastman Rochester. A limited number of American works each year, the orchestra to be an augmented Rochester Civic Orchestra to be known as the Eastman Rochester Symphony, and etc., returning to describing the recording program being carried out with RCA. The point is that that Eastman Rochester consisted of the local civic orchestra, augmented by faculty members and students of the Eastman School. They performed several times throughout the academic year, but at no time was the personnel published in a printed concert program, underscoring the fluidity of the personnel corps. So in this concert, concerto concert with student soloists. Our attention is going to be on the Concerto for Viola by William Walton. And I would note, before we hear the audio, there is an additional point of interest to this performance in that composer Walton rescored this viola concerto 12 years later in 1962, broadly advertising his preference for the new version of the work, and therefore, for the viola community, this recorded performance by the Eastman Forces represents a tangible artifact of this concerto's development. Excerpt, please. So accompanying an Eastman student, this professional orchestral ensemble. This morning, the question arose as to when the Eastman Register was discontinued. And the fact is that after the Eastman Register Symphony Orchestra made its last commercial recording in 1965, the Eastman School concert programs continued to cite performances by an orchestra called the Eastman Register Symphony Orchestra at certain designated events in the concert calendar. But again, the personnel never published in those programs. The last appearance of a so-called Eastman Rochester Symphony Orchestra was at a concerto concert in November 1973. And photographs taken at that concert indicate that the orchestra's personnel corps consisted entirely of students. So clearly, the orchestra's professional guys lapsed after the end of the orchestra's commercial recording activity. That leaves my time essentially completed. Questions I might answer. Yes?
Do you have any idea what engineer or studio installed the recording equipment back in the 30s?
There is documentation extant from the 1940s and 50s. But alas, the archival record for the 1930s is very scant.
The 40s and 50s only personally went to a studio to do it.
Oh, yes, indeed. We have documentation on file.
Was it Penyanko installation?
Off the top of my head, sir, I can't answer the question. I do invite you to follow up with me by email, though.
Okay.
Yes.
What was Hansen's problem with the musicians' union?
Several facets to that, best addressed by email. I don't want to say too much and risk getting it wrong, but there were some difficulties in that day, yes, there were. Partly perhaps dictated by Hansen's own political viewpoint. Others? Thank you very much.